we build up a great amount of support, and then, of course, price of oil went down. And when that happens, people forget. You know, they forget when what gave them the hangover.
A push in Congress to permanently close Anwar's coastal plain to oil drilling. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, the 7th of January. Good evening, I'm Duncan Moon. Also tonight, another day of frustrations for top-level cross-country skiers in Anchorage.
I don't know if we're on to plan C or D or E, but anyway, we're down to trying to hold the sprint tomorrow.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the Alaska Budget Report, providing in-depth coverage for state government since 1991, on the web at akbudgetreport.com.
The new session of Congress is only in its first week, and already it faces two competing bills dealing with the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. In the House, Alaska Republican Don Young reintroduced a bill that would allow drilling in the refuge, and Massachusetts Democrat Edward Markey reintroduced a bill to protect its coastal plain. The two bills have been resurrected from the last session of Congress, where both stalled. Congressman Young said he was expecting Markey to keep fighting over the refuge.
Well, you know, he's going to do that every year, just like I introduced my bill to open it. And it's always a tit for tat, and his bill hasn't got much chance, and mine probably doesn't either, but it all depends on the price of oil.
Markey's bill will preserve the Coastal Plain's 1.5 million acres, also known as the 1002 area. Even though that stretch of land is within the Arctic Refuge, it's not designated as wilderness. Congress and the president's signature could allow drilling there, but Markey's bill would permanently protect it. Even though Markey's bill didn't reach the House floor for a vote in the last Congress, environmentalist Kristen Miller with the Alaska Wilderness League says she has fresh hope this year.
It's very exciting to have the Arctic Wilderness Bill introduced in this new Congress and, you know, with the new President-elect Obama. You know, I think there's a lot of energy right now on changing the way that we do business in Washington, D.C. For the past 8 years, the focus for our energy future has been on drill, drill, drill. And, you know, it's time for us to take a step back and see what our energy future is going to be.
Miller says Markey's bill would send a strong message that wilderness is off limits to development.
This is very strong legislative protection. It would mean that it would be off limits for most motorized access, although it would still allow hiking and backpacking and subsistence hunting and activities such as that.
Miller calls the coastal plain an iconic area. But Congressman Young says its real value lies below the surface, in oil and gas deposits. His comprehensive energy bill would allow drilling in the coastal plain. Young says one benefit would be the establishment of a trust fund for renewable energy projects.
The money will go into alternative forms of energy and wildlife conservation. It's pretty much supported by a lot of people. I had 187 some odd co-sponsors. And so we will just keep working on it. I never give up on this.
Young admits his bill doesn't have much of a chance in the democratically controlled Congress with a Democratic president at the helm. But he says public opinion rises and falls with the price of oil.
We build up a great amount of support, and then, of course, price of oil went down. And when that happens, people forget. You know, they forget when what gave them the hangover. And then they'll hang around and have another drink of scotch, and then next morning they wonder why their head hurts.
Both bills have been referred to the Natural Resources Committee. The economy may be slowing down, but hunger is not. During the holidays, the Food Bank of Alaska distributed 30% more meals in Anchorage than last year. But hunger is hardly an urban phenomenon alone. A statewide study indicates around 85,000 Alaskans deal with food shortages. KSK's Len Anderson reports on how the food bank is trying to cope with the problem.
As Susanna Morgan gazes about the main area of the food bank's Anchorage warehouse, the executive director reports not all the news in the battle against hunger is bad.
The Farm Bill, which was passed in May of 2008, put some more money into purchasing commodities. And starting in December, we're finally starting to reap that benefit. So it's been a really great thing, but it's kind of coming in these waves that are making it a little harder to handle.
Hard to handle refers in part to the federal tendency to ship a lot of one thing at a time. rather than the nutritionally balanced combinations the food banks seek to provide the local distributing agencies.
The definition of a food bank is does a wholesale distribution to other agencies. In addition to the Food Bank of Alaska, there's the Fairbanks Community Food Bank, the Kenai Peninsula Food Bank, the Kodiak Island Food Bank, and the Southeast Alaska Food Bank, all of which have a wholesale component. Some of them, like the Kenai Peninsula, do a food bank, a food pantry, and a soup kitchen out of the same building.
The Anchorage facility distributes about 6 million pounds each year. Half of the federal food goes to the Anchorage-Matsu area. The other 50% is distributed statewide. Morgan says to meet the current needs, the food bank would have to handle 13 million pounds. The urban agencies are more likely to supplement the federal food with local contributions, which right now are precariously low in Anchorage. But relying on those locally procured foods enables the Food Bank of Alaska to send more of the federal commodities to rural Alaska. Federal commodities make up 90% of the food distributed in the rural communities. Morgan says hunger impacts about 10% of the state's adult population and 15% of its children. In rural Alaska, those percentages jump to 20% of the adults and almost 25% of the children. Just off the warehouse area is a rather barren first-floor conference room with a map of Alaska on the wall. About four dozen pins dot the map. Most of the food headed toward rural Alaska comes from the Anchorage facility. The pins show where it goes. Some appear on the Aleutian chain in the Pribilofs. A half dozen are in southeast Alaska. A trio march up around the northwest coast, Point Hope, Point Lay, and on to Barrow. Kotzebue is pinless. But Morgan hopes not for long.
Kotzebue, we're visiting Thursday and Friday and hopefully bringing a food pantry back on board up there.
Southwest Alaska has several pins. Morgan says it's not nearly enough. The organization has been working hard in the YK Delta and the Bristol Bay regions.
Because it's the largest single area of population in rural Alaska, but also the poverty figures are astoundingly high. So we have tried really hard to reach out to those small villages and make sure there's food assistance available.
Morgan says three main obstacles restrict expanding food bank services in the villages.
Physical capacity, they have to have a place to store the food. Administrative capacity, there has to be someone in the village who's willing to do this. And then lastly, the availability of the food. So we have had to, in some cases, not bring on a new village because we didn't have the food to ship them.
Despite the obstacles and the growing need, Morgan remains positive. Besides federal commodities and corporate contributions, she has great hopes for the Adopt a Village program. That's where urban congregations and service groups choose a community and hold food and fund drives to maintain a village food agency. It's a way that city groups can reach directly out to hungry rural Alaskans the same way they do their urban neighbors. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
Cold temperatures have once again postponed the U.S. cross-country ski championship races in Anchorage. It was the fourth day of cancellations for the six-day event. Spokesman John Quinley says it's been a frustrating run of bad luck.
You know, it's U.S. Nationals. It's the best skiers in the country all in one place for really one of the only times of the year that they're all competing against one another in the United States. So it's unfortunate that coincided with this string of cold days.
500 skiers from around the country are participating, but the races can't be held if the temperature dips under 4 below. Tomorrow is the last day of the event. Organizers will attempt to hold the classic sprint race. Quinley says his fingers will be crossed for warmer temperatures, but the forecast looks kind of iffy.
The representative from U.S. Ski Association was saying at a coaches meeting, he said, we're in uncharted territory here, that there's not much precedent for this large disruption in U.S. Nationals.
On Monday, the temperatures climbed briefly above -4, allowing organizers to go ahead with a shortened version of the skate races. Quinley says everyone agrees the temperature is important for safety.
They are working so hard when they're racing that pulling in that amount of cold air is just not good for the short or long-term health. And, you know, after the Monday's race, gosh, there were people with some white spots on their cheeks and ears and some very cold hands and feet. you know, racing at 3 or 4 below zero is really cold, and you don't want to push it more than that.
The athletes and coaches seem to be taking the cancellations in stride. Greg Rawlings is the head coach for the U.S. Adaptive Ski Team. He has 5 racers competing in the event, mostly sit skiers. He says his team has enjoyed their time in Anchorage despite the cold. They've been able to work out in local gyms and have spent some time on the ski trails with 5 moose sightings already. Rawlings says dealing with extreme weather is all part of the fun.
We play this game that involves Mother Nature and a bunch of frozen water, and sometimes the water is really cold and sometimes it's a little too warm. So it really varies. We've got we'll be going back to Colorado this week, and they have a lot of snow, and you know, there could potentially be cancellations because there's just too much snow.
University of Alaska Anchorage ski coach Todd Flagstad says it's important not to get too discouraged. He says his athletes have been thankful they haven't had to travel far for the event.
And I really made a point of it to my team early on that we were just going to stay positive and not let the frustration get to us, because then you will start racing bad too when you have races. So we've been staying pretty upbeat, I think.
The U.S. Cross Country Championships will be held again in Anchorage next year, where they will help determine who qualifies for the Vancouver Olympics in 2010. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, celebrating Russian Christmas in Unalaska.
We call our family and friends to hear them, to let them hear us sing, so that they can be spiritually home.
That's just ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds. On the web at arcticwirerope.com.
And by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Former Commissioner of Administration Bob Poe says he's ready to become the first candidate in the 2010 race for governor. Before his time as commissioner, Poe worked on and off as a consultant and general problem solver for 4 administrations over more than 20 years. He has done jobs as varied as designing the state's accounting system, serving as Director of International Trade, and also as Director of the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority and the Energy Authority. Between those assignments, Poe worked in private enterprise in management and consulting positions. He says he'll announce his intentions tomorrow morning in Anchorage to run in the next year's Democratic primary.
I'm not exactly a household name. I do think that my background makes me very experienced for this job, but the average voter in Alaska doesn't know me yet. So the 5 months or so that I have before May, when the 18-month trigger happens with APOC, allows me time to travel around the state and meet Alaskans and hear what they have to say, hear their concerns and their issues, and just meet the voters, let them get to know me.
Poe describes the management and business skills he would take with him to the governor's office if he wins.
And the real job of a governor is to find a balance in there, to find out how to do those things in a way that's best for Alaska. And, there's a certain art to that. The plus is, I served on the cabinet for 6 years. I've been through those meetings. I've had those discussions. I've been in opposition to other commissioners on different items. I understand how it works.
So far, no other candidate has declared interest in the race. Poe points out that state law prohibits raising money until 18 months before the general election. A major barge line serving Southeast is raising its rates, but it's also reducing its fuel surcharge. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Barge lines ship groceries, building supplies, cars, and beer, among other goods, to Alaska. Most retailers pass on the expense, so shipping rate changes can affect the cost of many of the items residents regularly purchase. One of the state's major barge companies, Alaska Marine Lines, plans to increase the cost of shipping to and from Southeast by 5% later this month. AML already raised rates for South Central service by 5.25%. President Kevin Anderson says the line is trying to keep up with expenses.
wages continually go up, our capital costs increase when it comes to building new equipment or purchasing forklifts, that sort of thing. Workman's comp took a huge hit this year. It goes on and on and on.
Another factor is fuel, but the company and its competitors calculate that separately. The last time Alaska Marine Lines didn't have a fuel surcharge was in 2002. It ran as high as 30% last summer, but it's been dropping. The latest reduction changed the Southeast shipping fee from 11 to 7.5%. It reduced the South Central surcharge from 15 to 11.5% last month. Anderson says he can't say how long the fuel surcharge will stay this low.
We have no control over the price of fuel, and just for example, we just lowered it to the lowest it's been in a long time, and now a week later, the diesel went up 40 cents a gallon, so you just don't know. It's a moving target all the time.
The fuel fee drop and the general rate increase come close to canceling each other out. The result is a small price hike. Northland Services, Southeast's other major barge line, has also reduced its fuel surcharge rate. It dropped from 14 to 11% last month. Northland also plans a 5% general rate increase in February. Overall fees are going up, in part because shipping is down. Anderson says fewer construction and retail goods are being barged, and tourism is down, which impacts the lines as well as other businesses.
All the curio stores, you'd be amazed over the amount of containers full of T-shirts and hats and all the trinkets that they sell. So it's a big part of our business.
Barge rate changes are reported to the Surface Transportation Board, a federal regulatory agency. But the board mostly focuses on rail traffic and does not limit barge company price increases. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Juneau.
The Southeast Alaska Conservation Council hired Lindsay Ketchell of Vermont last month to be the executive director of the region's largest conservation group. SEAC recently made another hire, but this time they went local. Bob Kloss of Craig will be the new Southeast grassroots organizer for the group. KRBD's Jay Marble has more.
Kloss is a recently retired Alaska State Trooper who was assigned to the Kluwak Post, which serves the island. If there is a stereotype for how a grassroots organizer of a conservation group is supposed to look, it's probably not Kloss. He's tall, athletic, has short hair and a mustache. He looks like a cop. But Kloss says he likes the career change.
Well, it's great not having to wear armor to work, although sometimes I might have to, it seems like, in some of these positions that I'll be taking. But the biggest issue for me is that what we're doing is very important, but it's not as urgent. So I'm not getting a call at 2 o'clock in the morning to go out and be on.
Kloss says he will be spending a lot of time in and around Ketchikan, which along with Prince of Wales has been the traditional territory of the Southern Southeast organizer. He says SEAC's decision to base a grassroots organizer in Southern Southeast addressed two issues. One regarding perception, the other practicality.
One is that people on the island who are actually making their living and subsistence hunting and subsistence fishing on the island had a perception that the organizers may not have understood as well because they don't do that.
Kloss says eventually SEAC will set up an actual office in either Craig or Kluwak, but for now, he's working out of his home. I'm Jay Marble.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Giving Coalition announces Pick, Click, Give, a whole new way to reach out and help Alaskans when you apply for your PFD online. Share part of your dividend with some of your favorite Alaska nonprofits. It's a chance for all of us to come together and give a little extra. Remember, when you apply for your PFD online, just pick, click, give. Information online at pickclickgive.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Giving Coalition.
The Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence is suing to stop a last-second Bush administration change that would allow people to carry concealed, loaded guns in most national parks and wildlife refuges, including the Sitka National Historical Park. KCAW's Bonnie Sue Hitchcock reports.
John Quinley, spokesman for the National Park Service in Alaska, says he can't speak to the lawsuit, but he says the proposed change to allow concealed weapons in national parks and wildlife refuges was announced a few months ago. It's now in the public comment phase until January 10th, and he says the ruling affects areas outside of Alaska more than it does here.
The effect in Alaska was that there were five parks park areas, national park areas, where you could not carry firearms, and that included Sitka National Historical Park. The rule change affected a smaller number of national parks in Alaska than it probably did in other places.
Quinley says the park areas in Alaska where firearms were prohibited were those that were in existence prior to 1980, when the Alaska National Interest Land Conservation Act, or ANILCA, was passed.
And that's Klondike Gold Rush in Skagway, Sitka. The old section, the sort of 2-million-acre old section of Denali National Park that used to, it was the former Mount McKinley National Park, the old section of Glacier Bay, and the old section of Katmai. Those were both, Glacier Bay and Katmai areas were both national monuments prior to 1980. And so in those former monument areas, carrying firearms had been illegal.
In Sitka, National Park Service Ranger Stephen Powers says in spite of the new ruling, it will still be business as usual at the Sitka National Historical Park.
While people can carry concealed weapons on the park grounds and on the trails, they still cannot enter the visitor center. It's still against 18 USC to carry firearms into a federal building. Can't go into the visitor center, into the cultural center, anything like that. Any buildings owned by the federal government, it's illegal to carry a firearm into.
National Park spokesman John Quinley says the Interior Department looked at the rule change as an approach similar to what other land management agencies like the Forest Service have taken in the past.
The need was to sort of more uniformly allow individuals to carry concealed firearms in parks to the extent that they can lawfully do so under state law, that national park areas would reflect the states in which they're located.
Neither Quinley nor Powers would comment on the lawsuit filed by the Brady campaign, except to say that if it stalls the proposed change, the Park Service will comply with whatever the courts decide. In Sitka, I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
Residents of the northwest Alaska villages of Shungnak and Kobuk are concerned about wolves near town. Shungnak Mayor Levi Cleveland says wolves have been spotted in recent weeks along the five-mile trail to Kobuk, as close as a mile and a half to the villages. Cleveland suspects the animals are looking for food.
There's no caribou, not that much around, and the moose population is not that that great around here, and they're hungry, I think.
Cleveland says as many as 10 to 15 animals have been spotted, as well as lots of tracks. He says it's uncommon for wolves to come so close to town. The animals have not shown any aggressive behavior, but Cleveland says area residents are being advised to be careful.
We just cautioned the young people that travel between here and Kobuk not to travel alone.
Cleveland says he's been walking his granddaughter right up to the school door. He says there are few local trappers, and at 40 below zero temperatures for the past week have kept local hunters from going after the wolves. State Fish and Game biologist Jim Dow in Kotzebue says he's spoken to several area residents about the situation and confirms the wolves have not caused any trouble.
Nobody's lost any sled dogs or dogs. There's not been any wolves in trash or dumpsters, but they're certainly seeing them very close to the villages.
Dow, who's worked in the area for more than two decades, says people have been seeing more wolves around area villages in recent years. He suspects the rise in wolf numbers is the result of fewer area residents going out hunting for the animals.
Gas in the villages has been between $8 and $10 a gallon for the last couple of years. Even in Kotzebue, it's over $7 a gallon. You know, I used to not be able to fly far enough in a cub during one day that I would not be out of sight of snowgo tracks. Now when I go out, I get 20, 30 miles from a village, and I see very, very few snowgo tracks. Gas prices are just keeping people in town. And so I think as a result, you know, the annual crop of wolf pups every year just aren't being taken.
Dow says wolf numbers also naturally fluctuate due to disease prevalence and the availability of prey. He says the hare numbers have been high and confirms there are few caribou in the area. Today is Russian Christmas, or Slavy, when followers of the Russian Orthodox Church in Western Alaska celebrate Christmas Day with carol singing, feasts, and a traditional tradition called starring. KUCB's Ann Hillman joined the celebrations in Unalaska.
A small
choir stands before the crowd at the senior center singing traditional Russian Christmas songs in English, Aleut, and Slavic. Next to them, a man spins a giant eight-pointed star clockwise. Many of the singers clutch open cell phones in their hands.
We call our family and friends to hear them, to let them hear us sing, because, you know, a lot of them are not here, so we want them to be part of it by calling them so that they can be spiritually home.
Kathy Dirk stands in line with other elders, waiting to share in the potluck feast. Tonight, she'll attend church before going starring with other community members. They'll carry the giant star from house to house while singing traditional songs. Father Jonah Andrew says they'll follow the star just as the wise men and others followed a star to find Jesus.
Even the events that happened 2,000 years ago is still alive today in our faith. Through the scriptures, we live it.
Father Jonah says in Russian, Slavi means giving glory to God. Julia Dushkin says starring, which stems from Ukrainian tradition, is a way to do that.
When we go starring at people's house, we always have the star go in first before anybody else. It's just like, you know, like you bring in Christ into the house.
On Unalaska's star, an image of Jesus in the manger with Mary and Joseph is painted at the center and is lit up with a small group of Christmas lights. The community usually travels with the star from house to house while singing for 3 days. For most of the songs, they spin the star clockwise, but on the final day, the community stars at the cemetery to sing for the departed. On that day, they spin the star in the other direction. Dushkin says when she was younger, different activities accompanied the starring as well.
They used to have one guy, used to have like a big bag, you know, or like a pillowcase, for instance, yeah. And they used to say, Mazuka, Mazuka, you know. They'd go around and say that, and then the people that owned the house, they'd go to them and then, and like give a loaf of bread or a can of something, you know. And then after they're done starring that evening, then whoever owns the star or something, you know, they'll divide the food up and give it to the people that are poor or needy.
Irene McGlashan says other traditions have died out too.
Oh, we used to carry lanterns, but they don't anymore. A long time ago, they had like square boxes with a candle in them, and it was covered with paper.
But some festivities, like coming together to eat fish pie, sing, and share with the community, continue on. In Unalaska, I'm Ann Hillman.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Len Anderson in Anchorage, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Jay Marble in Craig, Bonnie Sue Hitchcock in Sitka, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Ann Hillman in Unalaska. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. John Prophet is our webmaster, and I'm Duncan Moon. From all of us at the Alaska Public Radio Network, have a good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the Rasmussen Foundation, partnering with Alaska's nonprofits and people to improve the quality of life throughout our state. Learn more at rasmussen.org.
And by
BP Alaska. BP, where training Alaska's future workforce is a priority.
Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.